many people here suspect that there must be some involvement from north of the border here in Hong Kong.
And those north of the Hong Kong border are seemingly not ruling out taking any action. This is Thursday, July 25th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, controversy breaks out over who should help smooth the way in Kashmir. U.S.-China trade talks will resume in a Chinese city other than Beijing. And Russia carried out what it said was its first long-range joint air patrol in the Asia-Pacific region with China, a mission that triggered hundreds of warning shots. It's all on VOA Asia. China publicly addressed the possibility of deploying the Chinese military to contain the public unrest in Hong Kong for the first time on Wednesday. China's defense ministry said Hong Kong officials have the right to call in Chinese military to maintain social order in the city. Hong Kong's basic law says military forces stationed by the Central People's Government in the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region for Defense shall not interfere in the local affairs of the region. However, it adds the government of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region may, when necessary, ask the Central People's Government for assistance from the garrison in the maintenance of public order and in disaster relief. That piece of information preceded my chat with a radio voice in Hong Kong. Joining us is Mike Weeks, one of the co-anchors of RTHK Radio's morning show, Hong Kong Today. Mike, you've been rather busy with a continuing protest in Hong Kong, but things don't look to be finished in that city, do they?
Certainly not by a long way, Ira. I mean, things have actually got worse this last weekend. We had another mass protest on Sunday, which ended, as they always do, this was, again, on Hong Kong Island, somewhere between about 180,000 and 400,000 people took part. And the protest ended in Central, but some protesters, as often happened, then went on to Beijing's liaison office in Western, which is about a mile and a half further on across the island. And they gathered outside there, and they defaced the national emblem of the People's Republic of China and defaced the gates. And then they dispersed when police arrived. They sort of, again, were caught up by police about an hour later, and they fought a pitched battle with rocks being thrown and tear gas fired. But no one was injured in that. But at the same time, people who left the march, who were going back home to the Northwest New Territories, which is a part of Hong Kong, about an hour by train from the city center, were caught up by basically triad gangsters who set about them, about 150 triad gangsters who set about them with wooden poles and severely beat 45 people at least, put them in hospital. One was critically injured, is still critically injured. I think five others were seriously injured.
Mike, who are these people? Who are these triad gangsters?
Well, the triads, long time, they are the organized crime of Hong Kong, and there's various different groups. They've been around a long time. But in the past few years, they've been seen very much as part of the sort of loyalist forces. I mean, I don't know exactly who controls them, but they're seen as being loyal to Beijing loyalist forces. And they came out during the Occupy Democracy protests in 2014, and they just seem to have come out to teach these people a lesson. At the same time, it took the police more than an hour to respond to this attack, or somewhere between 35 minutes and an hour. They had hundreds of calls. It was widely known beforehand that the triad gangs were planning to do something. The police failed to respond quickly. It's really now led to huge public anger here over the police, whether they were colluding with these gangsters. One of the leading pro-Beijing politicians, Junius Ho, who's from this area, he's a rural leader in the area, was seen shaking hands with some of the attackers just before the attack happened.
What happens next? Permits have been applied for another march this coming weekend. Is there going to be more violence?
Well, I mean, the protesters are planning to go to Yuen Long, which is actually where this attack happened, next Saturday. So the potential for violence is huge. But I would imagine that given what happened and given the huge public outcry, huge public outrage over what happened, that the police will also be out in force to ensure that no violence does occur. And I think, I mean, if you look at it, if it was done for some sort of political reason to try and end these the ongoing sort of political crisis which was caused by the government trying to pass this extradition bill, it's made things worse. It's been a propaganda disaster for them, what happened on Sunday in Yuen Long.
Mike Weeks is a co-anchor of Hong Kong Today on RTHK Radio in Hong Kong. Mike, thanks so much for talking with us. As we continue on VOA Asia, we'll get a closer look at who attacked those protesters at the Hong Kong train station last Sunday. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find. A controversial bill giving India's government sweeping powers to designate individuals as terrorists passed a major hurdle in Parliament on Wednesday, as opponents warned the legislation was too broad and open to abuse. Russia on Wednesday accused North Korea of illegally detaining one of its fishing vessels and said it would freeze talks with Pyongyang on fisheries cooperation until that issue is resolved. Severe flooding has killed at least 61 people, displaced nearly 800,000, and inundated thousands of homes across a third of Bangladesh. That according to government officials, that after 2 weeks of heavy monsoon rains. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. We continue our closer look now at those who attacked protesters in Hong Kong this past weekend. I spoke with Lynette Ong. She's a political science professor at the University of Toronto in Canada. She's written about the gangsters that many say carried out the attacks. Professor, who are these people?
We do not know for sure. So there's no firm evidence who they are or where they are from. But there are some reports that they are local triad members, or they could be gangsters from China. So even though there's no firm evidence, I think Hong Kong, and especially in mainland China, have an established pattern of the authorities or pro-government forces hiring gangsters or hiring thugs to carry out dirty jobs, such as dealing with protesters, beating up protesters, dirty jobs that the authorities wouldn't send in uniform police officers to do.
Is this an implication that perhaps the government or the police force in Hong Kong paid these gangsters to do what they did?
So again, we do not know for sure. There's no firm evidence, but there are similar things have happened in the past. And the fact that I think these men dressed in white shirt were masked suggest that they do not want their identities to be seen. So that further adds to the speculation that they are indeed thugs for hire, as I have written in my research, which is a common phenomenon in mainland China and has been an established pattern in Hong Kong.
So how much are these? So these people are being paid to do this, is what you're saying, right?
I am saying if they are indeed thugs for hire, they are paid to do the job. And indeed, there is speculation, there's report going that that have been circulated in the media that they indeed paid a certain sum of money to carry out the attack on protesters.
How long has this been going on, and why is it going on if you're saying that these gangsters, as we are referring to them, are basically an arm of a government or some branch of government or police force or whatever?
They are not a branch of government. They are not part of the government at all. And that's exactly the point. The government or anybody, pro-government forces who want the protest to end, could go out and hire these people on a daily or project basis to deal with protesters. And after that, they can end the relationship with these people. So there's no way to trace responsibility. They are not part of government bureaucracy.
These are the people being referred to as the Triad. Is that correct?
Triads are members of Triad or secret societies or part of the mafia groups. That may well be the case, but they could also be just any individuals on the street, any people that you see on the street who are willing to work for their muscle power.
Has this situation been investigated at all by any official organizations? How long have they been around, and why have they lasted so long?
I think, Chief Executive Carrie Lam has publicly denounced the violence. Hong Kong police have arrested some people after the incident and have said that they belong to some local triad groups. So it looks like some investigation has been conducted. But there are also eyewitness reports that when the attack happened, the police could not be found until an hour and a half later.
How widespread is this geographically?
So thugs for hire, as I've argued in my research, is a common phenomenon that could be found throughout a wide range of countries, particularly authoritarian as well as semi-authoritarian countries, where the authorities often hire people with muscle power to go do dirty jobs that they wouldn't send the police or any uniformed security agents to go and do. So it's by no means restricted to Hong Kong or mainland China.
But is it all Asia?
No, it is not Asia. It's actually very common in Russia in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So during the Arab Spring, similar things have happened in Egypt as well as in Syria. So throughout all parts of the world, really not restricted to Asia at all.
What has this done to Hong Kong?
I think a lot of people have a stake in upholding the rule of law in Hong Kong, and that goes way beyond Hong Kong people, because Hong Kong's reputation as a modern financial center suggests that people, international investors who park their assets and park their money in Hong Kong, who invest in Hong Kong, have a stake of continued rule of law and peace and civil liberties being upheld in Hong Kong. So definitely this is going to hurt Hong Kong's legitimacy as an international financial capital, hurt the legitimacy of Hong Kong government, and by extension, the legitimacy of the Beijing government.
Lynette Ong speaking to us via Skype, a political science professor at the University of Toronto. Happening now in Asia, experts say China's latest defense white paper places greater emphasis on the role of its military and what it plays in homeland defense and internal stability at a time of increased competition with the United States. Remember to stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. A political storm has erupted in India over remarks by U.S. President Donald Trump that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi had asked him to help mediate in the long-standing dispute between New Delhi and Islamabad over the region of Kashmir. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan thanked Trump and expressed surprise at India's reaction. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
The beautiful but divided Himalayan region of Kashmir is claimed by both India and Pakistan, and the two nuclear-armed neighbors have gone to war over the territory twice since 1947. During Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan's visit to the White House Monday, President Donald Trump weighed in on the issue.
I was with Prime Minister Modi 2 weeks ago, and we talked about this subject. And he actually said, would you like to be a mediator or arbitrator? I said, where? He said, Kashmir. Because this has been going on for many, many years. I was surprised at how long it's been going on.
Trump's remarks mark a significant change from the long-existing stance in Washington, the Kashmir dispute must be solved bilaterally. They also triggered a firestorm in India, with the country's foreign minister refuting the assertion that India asked the United States to intervene.
I would like to categorically assure the House that no such request has been made by the Prime Minister to the U.S. I repeat, no such request was made by the Prime Minister to the U.S. President.
Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan met with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Tuesday and had high praise for Trump, who he says understands Pakistan's point of view. Khan told the Washington-based United States Institute of Peace that the disputed region of Kashmir remains a challenge to bolstering ties between Pakistan and India.
But unfortunately, because of one issue of Kashmir, whenever we have tried, whenever relationship has got started to move in the right direction with India, some incident happens, and that's all related to Kashmir. We go back to square one.
Some analysts question whether President Trump realized the consequences of weighing in on such a controversial issue for the region.
Well, India for many years has been official government policy to not want any type of external mediation in the Kashmir dispute because, according to India, there's nothing to discuss.
And others are left to wonder what impact Trump's Kashmir remarks and Khan's White House visit will have on the future of U.S.-India relations. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
This is VOA Asia. Now this news alert. South Korea tried to bring international pressure to bear on Japan by airing its complaint at the World Trade Organization Wednesday, the latest move in a festering dispute that has seen Washington's two biggest Asian allies lobbing accusations at each other. You're listening to VOA Asia. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says he'll visit China next week for 2 days of talks to end the year-long trade war between the world's two largest economies. Mnuchin said on CNBC Wednesday that he and Chinese officials will discuss a lot of issues, and he acknowledged later at the White House he does not expect that all of them will be solved.
My expectation is there'll be a few more meetings before we get a deal done. So I wouldn't expect we'll resolve all the issues, but the fact that we're back at the table at the direction of the two presidents is important.
The White House said in a statement the talks are aimed at improving the trade relationship between the two countries and will cover a range of issues, including the trade deficit and forced technology transfer. The Chinese are not investing money in the United States as they once did. In 2016, China foreign direct investment, its direct investment in the U.S., peaked at $46.5 billion, but close to 90% of that has gone. I spoke about that with Jake Parker of the U.S.-China Business Council. He spent the past 10 years in China. I asked him why, beyond U.S. tariffs, this has occurred.
I think there are three main factors that we should consider. The first is that China's People's Bank of China has clearly articulated that they want to restrict any misallocation of state capital. And at least 3 years ago, a number of Chinese entities that were going out were purchasing real estate, commodities, vanity-type investment vehicles such as sports teams that the state has since cut back on. Currently, the Chinese government is very focused on the types of activities of investments that would be of interest back in Beijing. These are the science, the technologies. They want their companies to go out and acquire technology that can be brought back to China. Unfortunately, in the U.S. market today, the political dynamics have shifted to such an extent that many of those areas are no longer open to Chinese investment. That's one dynamic. The other dynamic is that we're obviously seeing that some of the biggest investments from China that have been committed in the past are related to the U.S.-China bilateral relationship, particularly around energy investments in Pennsylvania, in West Virginia, in Alaska. And many of these have not proceeded as quickly as they would have in the past because the Chinese government is linking progress on those investment vehicles to progress in the bilateral trade negotiations. And as long as those tensions exist, some of those bigger investments are unlikely to proceed as quickly as they would have in the past.
What areas of the U.S. economy is being affected the most?
So I think over the last couple of years, the last 2 years at least, the Chinese investment has steadily declined. So the impact on the U.S. economy writ large, I think, is generally fairly small. However, of course, there is potential upside that's being lost, particularly in areas like Pennsylvania and West Virginia, that would benefit from new investments in these traditional energy sectors.
Is the U.S. trying to do anything, or is it just satisfactory right now that the status quo continues as far as the trade between the two countries are concerned?
I think that there is probably a disconnect between a national government messaging out of Washington, D.C., and the messaging that we would hear from local governments, particularly governors, who are much more interested in attracting jobs, investment, tax revenue, that they're less interested in the political dynamics between the two countries and the trade conflict. So as a result, I think today, at least if the Chinese government and Chinese companies are continuing to invest in sectors that the U.S. government considers to be sensitive, that we'll continue to see a moderation of investment going forward. It's going to come down to what areas China's companies want to invest in and threading the needle between what will be acceptable investments going forward.
Is this a permanent change as far as the trade relationship between the U.S. and China is concerned?
No, certainly not. The United States produces significant commodities that China is interested in, both on the agriculture, the energy, and frankly, in the access to the domestic U.S. market side. These dynamics will shift and change over time, as they always have. And as soon as the trade situation stabilizes and improves, I think that there'll be significant more Chinese investment that comes back to the United States in the future.
Jake Parker, Senior Vice President of the U.S.-China Business Council. This news break from VOA Asia. Companies in Indonesia and the United Arab Emirates have signed agreements worth a total of $9.7 billion during an official visit of the Abu Dhabi Crown Prince to the Southeast Asian country. That according to the Indonesian government. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Russia's embassy in Seoul on Wednesday denied that Moscow had formally apologized over an alleged airspace violation the previous day. That after South Korea said that Russia had expressed deep regret while blaming an equipment malfunction. VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo has more.
South Korea and Japan both scrambled fighter jets after they say a Russian military aircraft entered airspace near a group of islets claimed by both South Korea and Japan on Tuesday during a long-range joint air patrol by Russian and Chinese aircraft. South Korean warplanes fired flares and hundreds of warning shots near the Russian aircraft, and the incident triggered a round of diplomatic protests by countries in the region. Yoon Doo-hwan, a press secretary at South Korea's presidential office, said an unidentified Russian military attaché in Seoul told South Korean officials that the military plane appeared to have entered an unplanned area due to a device malfunction. Russia's public statements on the issue have not mentioned any technical problems, nor has Russia announced any investigation or acknowledged a violation of South Korean airspace. China's defense ministry said on Wednesday that China and Russia did not enter the territorial airspace of any other country during their joint patrols on Tuesday. South Korea and Japan scrambled fighter jets because both claim sovereignty over the disputed islets, called Dokdo in Korea and Takashima in Japan. The two U.S. allies are mired in a deepening political and trade dispute, which fanned concerns that it might undercut three-way security cooperation to fend off North Korea's nuclear threats. Japan's top government spokesman said on Wednesday the country's relationship with South Korea was in a very severe state, and that Tokyo would continue to urge Seoul to take appropriate action over a string of issues that have frayed ties. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast. Take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email voaasia@voanews.com. Thank you to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes, the managing editor, Diane Gao, and our team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. My name's Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.